from Breakthrough Nutrition, you're listening to NBS Nutrition, a show giving you a no bullshit take on sports nutrition and how it may or may not affect your performance.
Hello, everyone. My name is Clifton Duhon, founder of Breakthrough Nutrition, and welcome to the inaugural episode of No Bullshit, an inside look at sports nutrition. Our goal with the show is to give you an unbiased look at various topics within the nutrition industry and how it relates to you and your performance. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to our guest slash co-host and my friend, Mr. Anthony Almada.
Hi, Cliff. Thanks very much for the privilege of being your co-host.
Anthony, thanks for joining us. This is awesome. It's a real privilege to have you on the show and speaking with us. So for the majority of the people that have been in the industry, especially if you've been in the industry since the mid 90s, like I have, I mean, you probably know who you are. Especially if you come from that strength and conditioning background, although now you're kind of starting to migrate into the endurance field. But even if, you know, your background is endurance as an athlete, you would probably be hard pressed to not have come in contact with you through either products you've been involved in or companies you've helped create, research you've done. But for some of the athletes, the viewers, the listeners that might not know who you are, can you just kind of give us a background on you? You know, and let's start back in what I call your stock boy days, first job within the industry.
Well, that would be back in 1975, and I was a competitive swimmer from in grade school through high school, and then started working in health food stores back in 75, and I had to be driven to work because I couldn't drive a car, didn't have a license. And then combined that with wanting to be a doctor, so I was pre-med, took that through high school, college, and through grad school at Berkeley. And in those intervening years, I moved from working in health food stores or nutrition stores and was very enchanted by anything that one could eat or drink or take as a pill
right.
that would or may affect your performance as an athlete. And so over time, I became smitten by the whole notion of performance nutrition from a science or evidence-based perspective. And that's what I did in grad school, looking at antioxidants and exercise. And then started doing research in humans. This was in animals. Then at the VA, aligned with UCSF in Children's Hospital, and looking at performance in health and disease, muscle metabolism. And then co-founded EAS back in 1992. That came out in 93. We introduced creatine, monohydrate, to most of the world back in 93.
Right.
Started doing research studies in humans with on our own products with some top labs. 96 came across Vitargo from a very famous researcher whose lab had invented the method and the mechanism behind carbohydrate loading for endurance back in the 60s. His lab invented creatine loading for strength and power in the 80s. And I had brought him on to our scientific advisory board, and he introduced me to Vitargo from a study he had just done earlier in 96. And in 97, we put Vitargo into Myoplex, which is still the flagship product for EAS.
Right.
And called it Myoplex Mass, and that's how I got exposed to Vitargo. And in those intervening years between then and now, I've been involved in about 55 university studies in humans, cyclists, triathletes, swimmers, strength training athletes, football players, baseball players, look at the influence of diet and or supplements on performance and or body composition, and even some studies in disease patients.
So, you pretty much run the gauntlet when we talk about, you know, when we look at sports nutrition as a whole and what it is. I mean, you've been involved from basically soup to nuts, in one aspect of another.
Well, yes. And I've told people before that I'm like the Jim Carrey of the nutrition industry, in that I've been typecast as a sports nutrition guy, but I worked in a lot of other areas. In fact, I worked for a company for 5 years while I was in grad school. Called Metagenics. So they're owned by Amway now.
Yep.
But they're probably one of the largest direct-to-doctor brands, and they focus all on diseases and conditions. And I worked in that capacity. And if you look back when we first launched EAS, the first group that we went after were cyclists. It wasn't bodybuilders. And the first trade show we went to was Interbike.
Right.
And at that time in 1993, Interbike, people were taking Centrum multivitamin in Power Bar, and that was it.
Right.
Protein was a four-letter word. Oh, I don't need protein. Well, that's how different that is now. And we try to talk about what creatine would do. No. And so it fell on very deaf ears. And the endurance community is much less adventurous than the physique enthusiast community. And that's just the way it is. Although usually more educated, the endurance community, they are much less reluctant, much more reluctant to try something new. And they're much more loyal to something they've been using for a long time. But they'll change components of bikes or shoes or gear all the time.
Right.
But they're just, I'm good with desiccated liver and my salmon. Really? That's all you're going to have? You don't think what you're putting in your bottle could be have improved since 1995? No, I'm good. I'm good with Gatorade.
I mean, is that stuff still around?
So it continues to be a fun excursion to work into the mindset and the psychographics of the endurance athlete.
Yeah, I took that stuff probably back in the late 90s. And I mean, it was, you know, tasted like ass back then. So I'm sure it still probably tastes like ass now. And it does pretty much nothing for you. But we'll definitely kind of get into that. And so I'll let everyone know how we came to where we are now. And Anthony and I have been talking with one another since 2013. We first started exchanging emails through his company Vitargo when we were looking to bring on a different carbohydrate source for our athletes. And then our friendship just kind of developed from there. Anthony and I had a conversation probably in, I guess it was January or February. And like most of our conversations, it turned to just the state of the industry. When we look at performance nutrition and how things are, where they've been, where they're going. And I said, Anthony, I was like, I have an idea. I was like, I've been sitting on this thing. It's been rumbling through my head. I want to do some sort of video series, podcast series, whatever it might be, where we look at, you know, a no bullshit approach to the sports nutrition industry itself. So I said, Anthony, would you have any interest in, you know, coming on and helping with this and, you know, being the co-host, being the guest? And Anthony said yes. And here we are about three so months later, ready to do our inaugural episode, first episode of a no bullshit look at sports nutrition. So now there are other shows and podcasts that deal with this. The majority of those are geared towards the physique enthusiast, the bodybuilder, things of that nature. So what we're going to do is more look at the endurance community. But a lot of this stuff is, you know, like what I say is physiology is physiology. So what is good for one a lot of times is good for the other. So there's definitely going to be some crossover between endurance athlete, physique enthusiast, whatever it might be. Our goal is to give the viewer, the listener, just an unadulterated view of whatever the topic might be. You know, if it's going to be creatine monohydrate, if it's going to be caffeine, if it's going to be branching amino acids, whatever. We want to provide the viewer with just pure knowledge from a scientific standpoint. But also from that, you know, we call that bro science, where, you know, sometimes, you know, your athlete might feel a certain way when they take a certain product, whether that's good, bad, or indifferent, but there's no science to back that up. So we want to kind of bring all that together, mash it all up, and just give the viewer, you know, just some knowledge for them to take in their arsenal of what should I take, when should I take it, how should I take it, et cetera. So we will cover everything from supplements to overall nutrition plans and what have you. So today what we're going to look at is just the overall view of the industry of sports nutrition / performance nutrition. Look at what's good, what's bad, what needs improving. Anthony has been, I mean, you've been in this industry a long time. You've seen a lot of changes over the years. So it'll be great to kind of get your ideas and your opinions on where we've come, but still where we need to go. So essentially the first thing we want to do is we want to talk about, again, the industry as a whole. You know, how did it start? You know, how did it grow? Essentially what's led us up to this point now here in 2017? Anthony, can you fill us in a little bit about that and your thoughts on that?
That's like a 6-decade span you want me to touch upon.
Well, let's you know, start basic and then we can kind of fast forward through. I don't think we need to go decade by decade.
Okay. So I think the roots of performance or sport nutrition start with guys named Bob Hoffman of York Barbell. and Joe Weider. And they were very focused upon diet, and they saw an opportunity, an economic opportunity, to package pills or powders and or bars even, and offer them to the primarily the strength or physique enthusiast athlete as a way to grow muscle and get stronger with zero evidence behind it. And I think for a long time, even going back into the days of BC among athletes, they believed that certain organs would improve a certain attribute. So you would eat the heart of a lion to have that imparted to you as your courage. You would eat muscle flesh. I mean, training tables have not long been known to be oriented towards protein in the ball sports. And I think one of the biggest inflection points, or there actually are two, was the advent of Gatorade, which was a significant innovation back then.
Right.
Go back in the 60s, invented by a nephrologist at where the Gators play in Gainesville. Then you find Powerbar and Brian Maxwell and his wife in Berkeley. They come up with something you can actually chew, wrap it around the tube of your bike frame, and train with it and race with it. Those were very novel innovations that right now it's like a cell phone. Cell phone's been around forever. Or a color TV. No, they haven't. And so those types of innovations, although they are viewed as being archaic now, they were revolutionary and transformed the landscape of how an athlete could be fueled or what they would use. And so I think what really happened in the world of performance nutrition on the endurance side is that a lot of endurance athletes were engaging in resistance training as part of their cross training. And they were exposed to guys or girls that were more muscular and going, I kind of like that physique rather than the POW look. I'm going to put a little bit more muscle on.
Right.
And they start asking, what is that stuff that you're taking right now? And that curiosity inspired some to train in a different way and still be competitive and to try things they had never tried. There's this whole adoption diffusion curve where people are at the one end is the first person that has a fax machine back in the 70s or I think the early 80s. And the other end is a person who never buys a fax machine because I'm never, ever going to go beyond just sending something via the mail.
Right.
And so you find it in every tribe, the people that are adventurous and experimenters and others that are reluctant to eat, I'm still going to use my brick phone. I'm not going to go beyond my tube TV until it breaks. And then I'll buy a flat screen, even though it's only $400 at Costco or less. And so with those experimentations and those pioneerings into the other world, because the physique enthusiast community and the endurance enthusiast community, they do not intersect. It's very rare. Think of the people that you hang out with. They aren't muscle bound. They don't look like jocks. They look like endurance athletes. And the interesting thing about the endurance athlete is that you can't tell physically when they're walking around without a bike, without running, that they are fit. But when you look at a physique athlete, oh, that guy's fit. No, he may be training very hard. He may be using drugs or she, but that doesn't mean they're fit in how I define fitness. Because if I was to go run a mile next to them, I could do 2 miles while they were doing one.
Right.
That's what the endurance athlete thinks. And the physique athlete thinks, oh, what a wimp. I could snap him or her in half. And I bet they couldn't even lift their body weight with one bench press push.
Right.
It's a very interesting dichotomy. And they're very different mindsets. But there have been intersections. And so some of the first things that started to intersect were protein. Most, you find endurance athletes using carbs for a long time. Gels came out. What a wonderful innovation that was by the Goo clan.
Right.
And now you see beta-alanine coming. You see creatine coming across. Branch chains didn't start within the world of endurance. They started in the world of physique nutrition. And so there are these crossover. There's a blur. And as you mentioned earlier, there is some applicability. But if you look at the training stimulus for an endurance athlete, that signal that they get in their muscles get smaller, muscle fibers, but make more proteins in the form of enzymes that move fat around or burn fat and store more fat in your muscles as an adaptation to training as an endurance athlete. If you're a physique athlete, make bigger fibers. We don't really need to worry about burning fat, so we don't need to make a lot of enzymes to make or move and burn fat, and let's store less fat in our muscles. very different adaptations. That's why you rarely see a competitive elite endurance athlete or pro who's muscular in a way that, wow, that guy is, they work out.
Right.
Physically and visibly. It's very rare. And you rarely see a physique athlete or enthusiast who can do a 225 or 230 marathon. It's incredibly rare. They're a mutant.
Right. So basically, I mean, what you're saying is the training stimulus, it really dictates the way our body processes nutrients, macronutrients, maybe even micronutrients, you know, especially from a protein, carbohydrate, and fat perspective.
Yeah, I would say it's related to the metabolic fuels. We don't know enough, although there are definitely higher demands for protein in an endurance athlete, but I don't know if we could say that there is a dramatic difference between the two, but there definitely are. With the training adaptations will change how the muscles use fuel, what fuels they rely upon.
Yeah, and I mean, this is probably a separate conversation. We could talk all day just on macronutrient profiles for a given athlete. But one takeaway from this, if you would venture to say, do you think that most endurance athletes are underfueled in terms of protein?
Well, I would offer that protein is not a fuel. In fact, it's been shown in many studies now that the only time protein becomes a fuel is if you have an inadequate amount of calories. The body does not like to use protein as a fuel. It's only right. Starvation. And so I would say that they, especially female athletes on both sides, but more on the endurance side, because they're not oriented towards muscle building typically, they are under-proteined. And I think there's also an abundance of protein overconsumption on a dose basis, not daily, but dose. So we know now from a number of studies in humans, mostly in resistance training, but some in endurance, that if you take in, what's your body weight, Cliff?
185.
Okay, so you're just about my body weight. If you took in more than about 20 grams of protein at one time, if you hadn't trained, anything above that 20 grams would be wasted. You would piss it out, you would convert some of it into carbohydrate, and you would use it for energy. But you thought that 40-gram chicken breast dose that you ingested would be used for recovery and muscle building or rebuilding the proteins that you have broken down in your training. Nope, only half. Now, if you had done a multiple body part exercise, then 40 grams would be needed. But if you just did cycling, so I think on a dose basis, the endurance athlete often overconsumes, but on a daily basis, they often underconsume.
Right. So in speaking of the industry, I mean, we've looked at how it kind of started, you know, with Weider and we've had all these advances, you know, especially in the scientific community. What do you think, or how do you think, or where does the importance lie from a scientific standpoint for the continuing development of the sports nutrition industry itself?
Well, I think if we didn't have science, just like as in veterinary medicine, which most people can relate to because they typically take more care and invest more money in their pet than themselves and health-wise, is that if there was no science or research, a lot of things that are around us wouldn't be around there. Wouldn't be around us. They wouldn't exist.
Right.
There'd be no drive for innovation, no pioneering, no exploration, no experimentation. And so science or research studies themselves are not the end all. It's often a starting place or a midpoint, but it never stops at that one study. It always is moving forward. And in contradistinction, having an anecdote, well, I've tried this and this works, I don't care what the science says, doesn't mean that it works for many.
Right.
And I think the best example of that would be a study that was done out of a university in Australia, where they took elite cyclists, all male, which is typically what happens, and they had them receive beta-alanine. And beta-alanine is a non-protein amino acid that a lot of people put into pre-workout products
right.
in the belief that it would improve performance. And what beta-alanine does is it causes an itch response because it tickles a receptor that's specific to itch.
Right.
And a lot of people believe, well, if I get that tingle, it's going to improve my performance. And they did a very elegant design where they had people believe they were getting beta-alanine, but they got a nothing. They were able to figure that one out. They said, we're going to give you beta-alanine, but what they gave them was actually beta-alanine, or they gave them different types, or we're going to give you something that blocks the action of the itch so you won't feel it, but it's still beta-alanine, but they got nothing. They got a placebo.
Right.
And they found out that when they were to remove that expectation, that beta-alanine had no impact on performance on one dose. It takes at least 2 weeks of using beta-alanine to make a difference. Yet right. people take it before a race, before they train, thinking that it's going to do something for them.
It's
expectation factor, the anecdote.
It's that the whole pre-workout, and we'll probably get to that a little bit later in the episode, but it's that, how do you know it's working? Because I can feel it. Well, that's great. You can feel it, but what is it actually doing for your performance? So, I mean, that's a great example, especially in the pre-workout industry. And like I said, we'll come back to that a little bit later on. So given the current state of the industry, where we are today, what do you think the industry itself is doing right?
Well, I think what it's doing right is what I would call hitting the target. And the target here is defined. I mean, think of your typical target. It has a bullseye, then it has concentric circles or rings that go out. If you hit the target every time, yeah, that's kind of desirable. And that relates to the keyword quality, or this is a quality product. And I would say quality isn't defined by chemistry. It's defined by biology. Because if you were to be given a glass of, or a row of four glasses of wine, and they all were Cabernet Sauvignon, and they all were from grapes picked at the same spot, the same location, same time, and yet they went to four different winemakers, would you expect them to taste identical? Absolutely not.
Right.
They each have their own yeast, their different wood that goes in the barrels, different temperatures, one's in a cave, one's in above ground. They would be chemically different, and the quality would be defined by how it affected your taste buds and what your brain thought about it. Oh, it's a quality wine. Great mouthfeel. I get tobacco and a little bit of match and essence of blank blank, unicorn hair, whatever.
Right.
And yet only one would get the medal because the judges blindly decided this is the best tasting or highest quality wine. But that's biology. It's taste.
Right.
But what the industry has been going towards, because it's been regulated by the FDA, we need to make sure that if you say X, Y, and Z on the label and Y, B, and D milligrams respectively, that indeed it has that. That means it's manufactured to quality specifications, but it does not mean it's safe and effective. And yet people have been using that because they don't have data on the actual product to affirm that it's safe and effective. Oh, well, all these ingredients by themselves are safe and they may work, but we're going to use a lot less, combine them, and make sure that we pass the wand. And now they're magically synergistic. That continues to be existing. But I think that focus on hitting the target, the chemical manufacturing quality, is admirable, even though it was enforced by law.
So it seems like the biggest takeaway is that what we're doing right now, at least there is some sort of structure. There is some sort of specification from or regulation of the industry itself, when probably 20 years ago, it just ran rampant, right? People were producing stuff in their kitchen and, you know, putting sawdust in capsules.
Oh, they still are.
Oh, yeah.
They still are.
But I mean, hopefully as a whole, that's getting a little bit better, right? With the FDA at least putting out some guidelines for nutrition labels, et cetera. So that's, I mean, that's what's good.
May I offer one additional metaphor, Cliff?
Sure.
So what is the major or the main highway near your home?
I-40.
So think of it being 6 o'clock in the morning, Saturday morning. What percent of the people are speeding? 85, 90%.
Yeah, at least.
Because they can.
Right.
Because there isn't a photo camera every eighth of a mile.
Right.
What has happened is that people are behaving now like there's a photo cam every mile or every 2 miles. They speed up. Oh, they got the camera, slow down. Speed up, slow down. Now, if there was a photo camera every tenth of a mile, would there be any speeding? Absolutely not.
Right.
But so the industry is grossly under-enforced. People would say, oh, that there are no speed limits. There are no laws for speeding. No, they know what they are. They just know that they rarely get caught. Same thing in our industry. They rarely get caught.
Right.
If you get the web feed from the FDA when they inspect manufacturing facilities or warehouses, you'd be shocked at how many, oh my gosh, look at that brand. They got popped. Most people don't know that. The competitors bring it out when they try to sell another brand, but it's happening a lot more frequently, but it's still not getting big bat signal coverage in the news. It's just not done yet, but it's happening more, but still relative to all the brands out there, most people are speeding.
So what do you think that, what can consumers do? What can new product manufacturers do to improve upon this, this process?
Well, I think a good friend of mine, he's a PhD in chemistry and surf buddy, and he actually was once away from becoming a Olympic mountain bike athlete or BMX athlete. And he told me that in his explorations of different places where products are manufactured, powders, capsules, tablets, even in China, North America, US and Canada, at least, he remains to be shocked in how many companies which are defined as being reputable do not live up to the regulations, where you would find doctored or falsified documents in a trash can about the purity of an ingredient. And they were scratched out and then typed over, right and left, still. And not to, to bash China, but it's most prevalent in China. And almost all the raw material ingredients that are put into products that come over here, most of them originate from China. It doesn't mean that they're unsafe or ineffective. It just means that they're maybe need a little bit more rigor to affirm that they indeed are what they say they are. Branch chain amino acids. I mean, I've seen pictures of facilities where they derive them from duck feathers.
Right.
It's very, very, it's like a small animal sacrifice called, and it's gross looking, very, very unhealthy looking. But that's where they get them from, and the consumer would never know that. And so I think for the consumer, and the consumer really typically, and the retailer, they don't see the power that they have. So I tell, when I give seminars or talk to staff or athletes or coaches, I say, don't believe me. Don't believe the brand. Call them up and say, hi, you know, I'm looking at your product right now, and I love the claims here. This is great. Could you use some of the studies done in humans on your actual product that support that? Let me get you our director of science. And if you tactfully and politely push until you get, yes, here's your email address. Did you receive it? Look on page 44. That's our brand and product name. If you don't get that, you are being led by faith and evangelism. Doesn't mean they don't work. Doesn't mean that they aren't safe, but that's what's being done, because very few consumers ask for that. And until they do, people continue to sell based on faith and evangelism.
So do you think the responsibility for this falls more on the consumer or the manufacturer? So if we're manufacturing a product and we're doing everything that we can to ensure you're getting a quality product, or if we're doing the opposite and we don't care, we're just putting a bunch of stuff, you know, in a capsule and selling it to you, and the consumer buys it, who's at fault? Is it the consumer's fault? The manufacturer's fault? Do we need to share blame in that? You know, what's your opinion on that question?
Well, let's think of the Dieselgate with VW, with the engines that were supposed to be diesel getting certain mileage. How would the consumer be able to test that the product, or the car got 35 miles per gallon? It wasn't being jerry-rigged to actually pass emissions and get certain mileage. How could the consumer test that? It's very difficult to do. Yeah. So the obligation falls upon the manufacturer. There are regulations. That's why there have been criminal investigations. There are regulations related to if you make a product that says A, B, and C in it in amounts of 1, 2, and 3, and it doesn't, it's a misbranded, adulterated product that could be pulled from market. And if you keep on doing that, we could incriminate you or prosecute you criminally, especially if you add something to it that isn't on the label. Spike it. Yes, so there is that obligation for the manufacturer, but the consumer, as I said, they just do not realize their power. And imagine that if a big brand, pick of your favorite endurance brand, they got 25 calls a day from across the continent asking for that. Hey, I love your product. I love the claims. Can you send the studies? Well, if you don't have them, you're not going to buy it. What do you think would happen?
Right.
We need to have an emergency meeting. Right now, we're getting so many calls, we think we're going to start losing sales.
Right.
It would cause a significant seismic shift in the behavior of a brand, but it doesn't happen, so they don't need to. Because they're manufacturing to the code of the regulations. They're not required to do a study on the actual product. Someone would interpret that.
Right. So I don't know. I mean, you probably know recently there were two triathletes that tested positive for a banned substance. And they're now there are many, but there are two females in particular within the past month mm-hmm. that have been named that they tested positive. They're linking this to an electrolyte powder, I believe it is. I'm not going to say the name of the company. I don't know if you've looked into it. I it was brought to my attention. I looked into it. The company, I mean, just the name of it, just the label, puts up warning signs to me. But let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's say that they manufactured their product to the specification. They went above and beyond, but they did get tainted product from their manufacturer, where they get their raw ingredients from. So the question is, who's really at fault then? Is it the company's fault that's manufacturing the product, or is it the manufacturer who's producing the raw goods?
Well, if you look at the regulations for manufacturing a dietary supplement, you're obligated to test the purity, strength, and identity of an ingredient. And so if you know what the ingredient is supposed to look like when you analyze it chemically, and then one time they get a batch where it's different, this is different than what we've been getting for the past 2 years. Jim, Jane, could you come and look at this result? It's odd. Should we tell the manufacturer? Yes, we should. They didn't do that. So the other thing is, well, what if somebody, and this is similar to gluten, Cheerios had this problem where they came up with gluten-free Cheerios and they had 3 months of complaints and they had to pull like 14 million or 1.4 million boxes off the market. Is that if you have a person who's working at a contract manufacturer and they didn't get a raise because they worked there for 19 years and they bought somebody from the outside, they're now kind of pissed off. So I'm going to bring up a vial of 100 grams of testosterone, name your chemical form. And since I oversee the manufacturer, I'm going to get back at this manufacturer.
Right.
I'm going to add an Osterine. They turn around, look, dump it into this big blender that has like 1,000 kilograms of powder, dump it in. No one checks them. There's no testosterone detector when they walk into the building. Who would know where it came from? Unless you tested each batch after manufacture, you would never know. You would never know there's gluten in the product unless you tested each batch after manufacture. But almost all gluten-free products never do that on each batch. So it's a hope and a prayer. And fortunately, it rarely happens, but it does. So the onus is upon the ingredient manufacturer, the contract manufacturer, and the contract manufacturer's agreement with the manufacturer, the brand owner, to make sure that they are living up to GMPs and identifying exactly what's going to the product. If they did not do that, they are all at fault.
Right. So basically, you need to make sure all your employees are happy, right? Give them some days off, pay them some extra money because you don't want someone jacking up all your hard work.
So. Domestic bioterrorism. It could be done very easily.
Exactly. I mean, it's scary to think that just one, you know, especially in that line where there's so many people coming into contact with it from start to finish, just, you know, one bad apple can kind of ruin it for the whole bunch.
But the other side, and having worked with a good friend of mine who's a renowned either defense or plaintiff's or defendant's attorney for banned substance violations or actually doping. And he defended the gentleman that was behind the Balco scandal that had a lot of different athletes involved, Patrick Arnold. Rick Collins is the attorney's name. One of the most common default responses by an athlete who gets popped for a banned substance violation is they go right to the supplement. It's very, very easy to do.
Right.
And a number of them have been overturned because they actually get a batch of that supplement. No, it doesn't have what you say it does. We have the bottle that you had, which does it, but we've tested 15 other bottles from that same lot. None of it. We think you spiked it after the fact. So think of any criminal who says, yeah, I did it. You arrest me. I did it. Marion Jones didn't do that until irrefutable proof. And right. Then she cries on TV. No one's going to admit to it. Who admits to it? I dope myself before they even get caught. It doesn't happen.
Well, David Miller did it today, but he might be the one
exception. To very the, good.
One exception to the rule. So, but no, you're right. I mean, 99.9% of them are just going to wait until they absolutely have to have to admit to the wrongdoing. LAF, you know, we won't, you know.
That's the avalanche factor there.
Yeah. So essentially, you know, we've talked about the industry, what's good, what's bad. You know, it looks like what we need to improve upon is just continued and further testing, some sort of, you know, deeper regulation maybe by the government, but also just the consumer themselves really taking, you know, taking an advocacy approach and reaching out to manufacturers, wanting to see evidence, things of that nature. So hopefully going forward, we can, you know, kind of bring all that stuff together in the industry as a whole, and continue to push and improve the state of the industry, just so that, I mean, because the industry does have a bad rep, and I guess rightfully so, but hopefully over the coming years, we can change that for the better, right? So,
Cliff, think of this situation. So let's say that you walk into a nice bike shop and you see a pair of forks and they say 34% less drag, wind tunnel tested, yet they were $1,900. So if you had $1,900 to burn, you got every other component spiffed out on your bike. It's as light as it can be without breaking. All carbon, titanium components, hybrid metals, unobtainium, upright posts, everything you could ever want. And you had $1,900. Would you drop it on a $1,900 pair of forks? If indeed it had 34% less drag, you would say, can I see the results? Which wind tunnel was it done at?
Right.
But when you buy a supplement, no one ever asked for anything like that. It says clinically proven or university tested. Show me the results. But they don't ask for that. There's a very interesting split when it becomes something you put into your mouth and hope it works, rather than something you can touch and hold and look at. It goes into the black box of the body. And that is why I think, in part, people suspend critical thinking and buy on faith, because it's unseen.
Right. I mean, the whole faith aspect, I mean, we could talk about that all day too, just how, you know, cross your fingers, hold your breath, and, you know, and hope that it works.
What if I got to lose? It was only $40.
Exactly. You know, so I don't know, maybe if we all raise the price of our products, you know, to $1,900, people would start asking more questions, right? So let's talk a little bit about certification of product. And this is actually good, because I had a coach reach out to us today, and she was really confused just about NSF certification versus USP certification versus FCC for certification. Just can you kind of walk us through that process, and, you know, why the majority of the industry should maybe go towards a clean sport certification or an NSF certification?
So you're talking about banned substance certification or testing, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So there are three main groups. There's informed choice, BSCG, and NSF. And those are the three most prominent. And they all compete. They all claim to have the best protocol, the lowest detection limits, et cetera. And it goes back to what I was saying earlier. If you are a competitive athlete who is being tested, then wouldn't you want to have the assurance, independent on each batch of everything you put into your body, especially in a supplement, where there's the highest chance of something being altered, not the Contador spiked meat hypothesis, but the actual, there have been a lot of products that have failed for drug testing, is that each batch with expert in the hands of experts that did not have detectable amounts of anything that was similar to or identical to what was on the WADA list, which probably is the most comprehensive list, the World Anti-Doping Agency list, which gets changed one or two times a year. I would want that. I mean, right. I've been an expert counsel for two different athletes that had a failed drug test. One was pro, the other one had a big Nike contract pending. And the pro athlete we overturned. The Nike athlete, nope. It was in a dietary supplement. And the rules at the time did not require from WADA, they did not explicitly describe DMAA, which is back in the news again.
Right.
But it was a chemical cousin of it that was listed. And so if it didn't have it described on the label in a way that you understood and you weren't sure, where would you go to find out? I mean, USADA and the Ultimate Fighting Championship, UFC for mixed martial arts, they issued a press release about a week ago. UFC wrote, do not take any dietary supplements because they are a known risk. In bold, don't take any. And so I think the only real salvation or confidence-inspiring tactic for an athlete to pursue, especially a drug-tested athlete, especially, is to rely upon one of those three certifications on the highest level to make sure that it's every single batch, because you can get a lower level,
right?
But you can get a lower level or a higher level of detection. So you can get super sensitive and detect tiny amounts. You can get it tested in every batch, or you can get both. That's a really important thing. Every single batch. And if I was an athlete, we work with Michael Phelps, every single batch that we had done, that we produced, we would always have the certification on the website for BSCG whom we use. So I think it's essential.
So do you think going forward, we'll say the next 2 to 5 years, that that's going to be mandatory from the government maybe to go through that testing?
No, I don't think so, because it to me doesn't really relate to the quality of manufacturing. It's much more of a personal or social recognition issue rather than a biological hazard. You find very few relatively adverse events associated with dietary supplements,
right,
relative to over-the-counter drugs.
Yeah.
There are many deaths associated with over-the-counter drugs, very, very few associated with dietary supplements. And so there's that benefit-risk ratio, or risk versus non-risk ratio. And when you don't have many people dropping, you don't find athletes bonking and then crashing and dying because of a supplement they took. They'll bonk because they underfueled or underhydrated or too much sodium, but not because of a supplement. It's very, very rare. And
right.
So where it becomes a societal issue and one that is an ethical issue is when you have an elite athlete or pro athlete who fails a test, and now it's not their health that people are concerned about. They cheated. She's a cheater.
Right.
We don't like her. Bad girl. Bad. And you don't find that in terms of, oh my gosh, I hope they're okay. Well, I hope their liver falls out. They don't think that way.
Right.
You should be stripped of all your medals or your winnings or both. Bye-bye, Nike. Bye-bye, Hoka. Bye-bye, Cervelo. Nope, you can't have those agreements anymore. They're not concerned about health. And FDA is not in there to protect the rights of or criminalize the actions of an athlete for using a banned substance, from my perspective.
So do you think that, let's change gears a little bit. Do you think that doping in endurance sports is prevalent right now?
I think it's most prevalent if you go into multi-sport among the age groupers. Absolutely.
So you think more age groupers are doping than professional athletes?
Well, think of how many age groupers that you work with that are not drug tested.
Right.
So if you're in the pro category, guess what? Cliff, could you come over here? Yeah, it's time for the cup. Usually they won't get blood. But if you're a pro, if you're an Olympic pro, you are being scrutinized under an electron microscope 4, 5, 8 times a month. December 24th, 6 p.m. Oh, wait. Oh, it's Santa. No, pee in the cup.
Yeah.
And when you are an age grouper, and most races don't test because they don't have the money to do it, guess what? Heck, my buddy, dang, that banker guy, he keeps on beating me. Oh, I'm always ahead of him out of T2, but he always gets me in the half marathon. Every single time.
Right.
And then they find somebody, why don't you try this? It's, you know, it's kind of legal. No side effects. Try it. Then all of a sudden, poof, he blows by the banker at mile 10. And he's gone, never touched again. And of course, when the banker said, well, what are you on? How did you beat me finally? Well, I just changed my training.
Yeah.
I took blank before some supplement. No. And a friend of mine actually reviewed a paper that was done, published a couple of years ago, where they looked at age groupers, triathletes, and they estimated, Megan, not everyone's going to admit to it, in a blind questionnaire, around 20%. I think it's 40 to 50% up to.
Yeah, I mean, I think we could do probably a whole episode just on the hormone replacement therapy that's, you know, your older athletes are going through now. Is that Is that legal? You know, we might even be able to talk about, you know, when a female gets pregnant. I mean, Serena Williams or Venus, one of the Williams sisters, is pregnant now. They're talking about she was, you know, possibly pregnant when she won her last title. When a female becomes pregnant, I mean, their body gets, you know, flooded with all kinds of hormones that could possibly enhance performance. You know, we could have a whole discussion on whether that's, you know, is that giving them an upper hand and is that fair? I mean, so it's kind of crazy, but, you know, I think you're correct. There are a lot of age groupers that are probably taking something that they shouldn't be. And we hear on a monthly basis just about some age grouper that's getting popped for, you know, taking something. So it'll be interesting in the coming years for sure.
And what you also find, which is an interesting thing we've seen in a number of sports, is that the actual drug testing that's done at an event, it's done usually the day of or the day before. If you would have to be an idiot to fail a drug test the day of the day before.
Right.
Why didn't you stop? Didn't you think about clearing from your body? Oh, my buddy said it'd be okay. You would have to be a fool to do it. And so then the other factor is that when you look at the tests that are performed, they don't go through a battery of 400 drugs. They go through a battery of 35. Well, we didn't have any money to test for diuretics. We didn't want to pull blood, so we can't test for EPO. Well, we just got urine.
Right.
So if you're half smart, you'll know what the tests are. You'll know who the organization is or the lab. There are only two WADA certified labs in the U.S. One's in Salt Lake. One's at UCLA. And I've talked with the director of the lab in UCLA in Utah, Dr. Dan Eichner. And the stories that I hear, it's like, oh my gosh, it's unbelievable what they find. And yet most of it never goes public.
Right.
No. And so when you have so many different holes you can sneak through to get around it, and the accessibility is so high and the cost is often low, heck, why not?
Right.
My friend's been using it for 4 years. He finally told me he looks great. He's got no side effects. Why not?
Anthony, thank you so much for joining us today. Guys, join us next week when we answer the questions, are proprietary blends red flags, and what the hell is marketing science? Until then, train hard and take no bullshit.